a 356-page monograph for the Thirst work. A 356-page monograph for his Thirst work was published in 2005 by the Monticelli Press, titled Emotion is Promotion. Throughout his career, Rick has publicly presented his works to over 100 audiences in 6 continents. His works are included in the permanent collection of the Cooper Hewitt Design Museum, the Library of the Museum of Modern Art, and the 2006 Triennial Design Life Now. Rick Valizenti provides inspiration to his colleagues and mentorship to a generation of students. For the past 2 decades, Rick has lent his time and energies to college and high school students in the form of workshops and personal critiques on the design industry. I had a great conversation with Rick, and I really feel like we got to be friends throughout the afternoon that we spent together having lunch and then recording the podcast. And then I drove him back to the airport so he could fly back to Chicago. And so without any further ado, here is my podcast conversation with Rick Valizenti.
Everybody puts their glass always in the same spot. Yeah. Every cabinet's always the same.
It seems like that just feels like where they should be.
Yes. That's a DNA thing.
I guess it is. It's one of those things that I want. Is it designed, or is it? Do we design it that way because it feels right?
Yes, I think so.
You know?
Well, no, you're right on. It feels right.
But why does it feel right? Does it feel right because somebody did it that way and everybody just went, oh, well, that's where it's supposed to be because that person did it that way? You know, like they talk about how people in Barcelona talk with a lisp? I'm recording.
Okay. What day is this, Duncan?
It's, what is today? Saturday, the 23rd.
We're in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas, and this is Rick Valizenti.
And this is my friend Duncan, the ghost.
I love it. I wanted to hear those conversations with designers like the comedians are having in their podcast where they're just talking about where did you come from and why do you do what you do. What they're doing and what we're doing has a lot of crossover. You know, we're passionate about what we're doing and we're expressing ourselves in one way or another, you know. I wasn't finding that in designers, and I wanted to hear that from designers. So I want to do that. And then I talked to some people at school about it, and I said, well, that could be a thesis. And I said, really? I don't have to design something? And they said, well, you're talking about design. It's design discourse.
And not only is it design discourse, you're kind of designing the interface.
Yeah, and I will, yeah.
I mean, no, this is the interface,
sure,
right?
True, yeah.
Because you're giving access to content,
mm-hmm.
and you just happen to be doing it through a series of questions, which could become your, like, pull-down menu.
Right. Well, and I even thought, you know, my original thought was it would be a book, you know? And I just thinking through the more traditional way someone would approach that project would be that you would do... I was influenced by... I think he just goes by Pash. He's in LA, and he did a book called Inspirability, and it was all short interviews with designers about what inspires them. And also Adrian Shaughnessy's books in general, especially How to Become a Graphic Designer, How to Be a Graphic Designer Without Losing Your Soul.
Right.
I found that in London. I was in London on a family trip, and I found this cool little design bookstore, and I went in there, and I was like, that's what I've been trying to figure out. How do I do this without losing my soul and feeling like I don't, you know, get to put my heart into it and not feeling like I'm a slimy salesperson?
Well, I think you should also look back a couple decades ago to Rudy Vanderlands.
Yes.
And what he did with Emigre Magazine. Because
yeah.
when there was a dearth of discourse and conversation and all of the design was feeling commodified and off the shelf, it took an outsider coming to America, pick up the phone and call people who he would uncover doing things perhaps that were, as you mentioned, passionate or left of center.
Mm-hmm.
And he would pick up the phone and call, and some may have been his friends and some may have been people he never knew, like myself.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just start to talk. That became the interview.
Yeah.
And then he would say, oh, will you make some work?
Okay.
Or can I showcase your work?
Yeah.
And before you knew it, he put together another issue. Hmm. And then before long, he had 67 or 68 of those issues.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, oh, Rudy, you completely redirected the discourse of design.
Valuable things a design student could have, I feel like. You know,
it's
so far outside of just the typical design literature you can find. But it's so much more what we really should be reading, I feel like. Of course, we all need to read like two or three books about typography. And we all need to know about color theory. And we all need to understand something about design process and theory. But really, the questions that Emigre was asking, those are the questions I think that need to be answered and that we need to be talking about more, you know.
Right. And the other thing that I felt, having scoured those issues, you know, they would get tattered when they would show up in my house, was that the subject matter, in other words, my colleagues, most I didn't know,
mm-hmm.
gave me permission to be me.
Sure, yeah.
And then in retrospect, you look back and you go, oh, he was talking like Ed Feller or Jeff Keady. Mm-hmm. Oh, they've since become friends. Or maybe Von Oliver or Barry Deck or David Carson or whoever.
Yeah.
And like, thank you, Rudy, for being that conduit. And on the other side of the ocean, there's Neville Brody, who was doing it through the Fuse work.
Right.
And he would invite a variety of designers, myself included, to make a font.
Oh,
and
nice.
He would have themes. And now he's just reissued all of the Fuse fonts and the posters that went with it.
I have that book.
I do too. I kept mine unopened.
Oh, I had to open mine.
I didn't want to break the seal. There's a few books I have unopened.
In that trip where I went to Germany last summer, we got to meet with Lucas DeGroe and Peter Billick in The Hague.
Too bad.
Oh, it was great. Like I mentioned earlier, I'm quite a type nerd. And so sitting down and listening to those two talk about how they do what they do, it was just, and we were there for a type conference to begin with in Berlin. And so, sitting down and listening to them talk about it. And then Lucas showed us the project that he did for Fuse and all the animations for the typeface. It was about sex. And so it was all these, I think he just took, he took his thesis typeface and then he took drawings that he had made and he morphed them from thesis into the drawings. So they would end up looking kind of pornographic. And his face lit up so much when it was like he was a little kid, you know? And he was like, look at these drawings I made.
That's the moment when we were just being ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that you might want to keep in mind is as you travel, pack an extra suitcase with this equipment.
Oh, absolutely.
Because you will encounter the vernacular type designer, the vernacular sign guy, or the professional.
Mm-hmm.
And someone equipped with this and the knowledge as to what questions to write will become an impresario, for a profession.
Yeah.
And right now the profession, from where I stand, is probably looking for one.
Yeah.
That Rudy has stepped away.
Mm-hmm.
The Debbie Millmans have only a certain level of relationship to leverage and a certain perspective, you know, to amplify. But someone who's coming to the profession from another plane and another generation, oh my God, you would be so valuable.
That's what I'm hoping.
Make this the inauguration of the Ghost production.
I'm all for that.
Good, I've just branded you your own name.
Fantastic, I love it.
Here we are with Ghost Productions presents An Afternoon with Rick Valicetti in Austin, Texas. I'm seated across from Duncan, what's your last name? Tell the audience.
Duncan Robertson. Thank you for joining me this afternoon, Rick.
You're welcome. Now we can begin.
Okay.
Yeah.
But most of the questions that I have are kind of there to get things started, I guess, you know, and then we'll, kind of like we've been doing, we'll get off somewhere else, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So one of the really basic things that I'm curious for all designers is why did you become a designer?
If I answer with the truth, it might sound like one word, but if you give me time, I'll fill in the blank.
Absolutely.
After the word.
Yeah.
By mistake.
Okay.
Okay. That's two words, actually.
Yeah.
But I studied undergraduate at the in painting and drawing with an emphasis on design.
Mm-hmm.
I also was exposed to photography at Bowling Green State University. I graduated in 1973. I moved from south of Toledo, Ohio, back to where I grew up in Pittsburgh, and it was my first exposure to a recession. There was absolutely no jobs for someone who had nude life drawing images and nude photography and a couple of handcrafted designs in his portfolio to score a job professionally. So I spent 2 years as a United States steelworker in the Pittsburgh steel mills. Actually, I was in an area just south of Pittsburgh in a surgical steel foundry.
Mm.
But I was punching in, wearing a hard hat, steel-toed shoes, bought myself a pickup truck, bought an expensive camera, bought some darkroom equipment. And I thought, I'm going to be a photographer because the steel gig is just torture.
Sure.
It wasn't that it was hard. It was just grueling and repetitive. But it became the quickest trip to graduate school. About a year and a half in, my father dies,
mm-hmm.
and I got to do something with my life. So I make 7 applications, 4 in painting, 3 are in photography. I'm accepted to all of them, and I select the University of Iowa. I go there. While I'm there, I'm on a TA teaching drawing. I'm studying photography. I am also taking a letterpress class. I leave Iowa, go to Chicago. My mother has since moved to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And when I look at the Chicago scene now as a photographer, I see them shooting hot dogs, cornflakes, and beer. I go, oh, there's a McDonald's and Oscar Mayer. There's Kellogg's and Post. The ad agencies are doing this stuff, right?
Uh-huh.
There's Miller Beer and Budweiser. Maybe somebody's photographing cigarettes. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm failing to see the really fabulous tradition of fine art that's come from the new Bauhaus.
Mm. To Chicago.
Chicago.
Right.
I'm failing to see Moholy Nagy's evidence and Aaron Siskind and Harry Callahan. I'm not witnessing those practitioners. I'm not even seeing the work of Hedrick Blessing or the fashion photographer Victor Skrobnesky. I'm just seeing this commercial hack, and I go, you know what, I'm not going to do this. So I look around, and I beg for a job as an advertising person. I know shit about advertising, and every time I'd go into a studio, I would discover how little I knew. I didn't know how to make a magic marker drawing. I didn't know how to key line and paste up. But I would quickly absorb that. 50 interviews later, I'm begging for a job. I finally get this woman to say, yes, here's where the mistake happens. And she says, you know, you're going to leave here shortly. You're overeducated for this agency. It was a recruitment ad agency where we would make small ads about the size of a postcard that said plant manager or accountant. And they'd stick a logo on the lower left corner or right corner, justified type from an IBM Selectric machine. It was all very hack and handcrafted. And it would only be printed one color in a newspaper, usually on Sunday.
It sounds very familiar.
Yeah, if you've been there, you know.
Yeah.
So I left after 6 months. I was happy to leave. I thought that was a semester. I'm unemployed. For 2 months, I accept a job as an insurance company designer doing forms and cafeteria flyers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm replacing a woman who's pregnant. And in 1978, I now have discovered on a telephone pole a flyer for a design conference for a group called ICGRADA, which is the International Congress of Graphic Design Associations. It's having their annual conference at Northwestern University.
Okay.
I take it off the telephone pole because I'm now the insurance company's in Evanston, Illinois. I take it off. I show it to the art director. I said, do you think the insurance company would let me go there? He goes, no. I said, what do you
Why
mean?
Would they do that?
Why would they do that? Exactly. I said, no, no. How about if I just take the time off? He goes, well, on your dime, take the time off. So I do. And upon entry to this conference, there is an exhibit by the graduate students from Cranbrook. I thought I was in a parallel universe. I'd never seen work that looked quite like this. This is 1978. Maybe
1978
a little...
Cranbrook is a little out there.
Yeah. And Kathy McCoy, a Chicago designer, has gone there with her husband, Michael, and they're making very peculiar work. Maybe it's, I think it's 1978. And on the podium were speakers like Massimo Vignelli.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Kaplan was speaking. I thought, who are these people? Massimo is showing the subway signage program he's just completed for the Washington Metro. He has these kiosks, and the discussion was whether that Helvetica was more effective sort of as stalactite or stalagmite, as it dangled vertically. And I thought, this is so interesting. And in his slideshow, he shows the Manhattan subway map. At the lunch break, I go out, and I'm not knowing anyone. So I go to the reception table where there are a couple of ladies who are now my age, but they look like old ladies then.
Yeah.
And I start to talk to them, and the woman says, why aren't you talking to the other people? I said, well, to tell you the truth, I don't know anybody here.
Yeah.
And I'm not really a designer. I'm just sort of like observing. She goes, really? I said, yeah. I said, you're awfully nice to me, you know, so I'm going to just hang out here. And we talked for a little bit, and finally I said to her, is there anything I can do for you? You're so nice to me. She said, well, as a matter of fact, there is. We're having parties at different houses, and we need maps on my table tomorrow morning that show the map of Evanston and what languages are spoken at what houses.
Wow, okay.
That's what I went, oh, I can make those maps. I just saw how a map was done
from
the Manhattan subway system.
From the man who makes the best maps.
That's right. So I was pulling all-nighter at the insurance company using their very bad typesetting equipment to come back the next morning with 2 8.5 by 11 maps mounted to foam core with a little cardboard easel on the back. I put them on her desk. I hand-cut little flags that showed what country the languages were and what houses. She was so grateful. At the end of the conference, she pulled me aside and she said, you really do want to meet a designer, don't you? I said, I'd love to meet a designer. She said, well, my husband's a designer. I said, oh, great. Well, little did I know that her husband studied at the New Bauhaus in Chicago. And he's 65, or he's 61 and a half when I meet him. His name is Bruce Beck. And they're in Evanston. It's so perfect. So I go over to meet him. I'm dressed in my suit that I used to wear for the interviews. And I have a portfolio full of cafeteria flyers, insurance forms, and bad newspaper ads.
All the work you've done.
All the work I've done. That's what you're supposed to do.
Right, yeah.
And a couple of magic marker renderings that look like ads. We flip through it, and he says, I hate your work, but I love your style. He says, you were so nice to my wife. Is there anything else you would like to show me? I said, well, I do have some letterpress and some photography in my portfolio. And he perks up.
Yeah.
He goes, I have a letterpress in my basement.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he said, that's where I hope to go in about 4 years. And when I retire,
into the basement.
Into the basement. I said, oh, well, let me show you. And I pull out all this stuff, and it's clearly different. And it's different from what I'd been doing. But in the letterpress tradition, I took it at the Writer's Workshop at the University of Iowa.
Cool.
And then I show him some of my photography, and I was a very good printer. Mm-hmm. And I could compose, I thought, like nobody else. Or like the canon of photography. He said, you know, I'm looking for somebody to run my darkroom and be my personal assistant. He said, do you know how to ink? I said, do I know how to ink? I've been inking these borders for these ads. I am so good with the rapidograph pen.
Yeah.
I can do a half point rule. I can do a 12 point rule. I can do a Scotch rule. And I know how to do that. He goes, you're hired.
Cool.
Yeah. So I became his ninth employee.
Nice.
And his last employee. And during that time, this mistake, just by standing in that lobby, by pulling that flyer off the telephone pole, by quitting that job downtown at the ad agency because I couldn't stand it anymore, I find myself working with a guy who plays host to Chicago's best as they come through the office. They all know who he is. I don't know who any of these people are. You go, oh, I'd like you to meet Robert Vogel, or I'd like you to meet R. Hunter Middleton, or I'd like you to meet John Massey. Later do I find out who these people are. And in my third year of 3.5 years, Bruce has me on the STA board, Society of Typographic Arts, and I'm, perhaps by default, not because of any kind of credibility, I'm the president of the STA. And on my board is a woman named Susan Jackson Kaig, who's still alive. She was the first woman to practice graphic design in Chicago. She, too, was in the New Bauhaus.
That's it.
Yeah, Jay Doblin, who's a group called the Doblin Group. Jay was one of the deans of that new design school after Moholy and after Ivan Shemaev's dad, Serge Shemaev. And Jay did an amazing thing as he changed our discourse of design and our methodology by founding Unimark and bringing Massimo Mignelli over from Milano.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of the history. These people are on my board. John Massey was there. I don't know these folks, and they think I'm kind of the class clown, so I can facilitate their conversation.
Sure.
One thing leads to another, and I'm on my own. Bruce retires. We talk about a partnership. I'm freaked out by the idea. So the STA puts me up, and since 1981 on April Fool's Day, I have been self-employed or unemployed.
On April Fool's Day.
On April Fool's Day. That's when I went on my own. And that has been very good. But somewhere along the way, I had to ask, is this it?
Yeah.
You know, because I was pretending to be somebody other than who I was.
Yeah.
Because I never had but one real good mentor in Bruce, I could only behave like I thought a designer was supposed to behave.
Yeah.
And it never really felt like I was in my skin.
Okay.
I felt like I was in somebody else's skin.
Yeah.
And all of that was kind of a send-up to a long period of about 7 or 8 years from 81 to 88 to kind of figure out what was wrong with me being a designer.
Hmm.
I was quite successful in kind of like 0 to 60 happened automatically. I was able to build a staff and get a 2,500 square foot space, and I was kind of rocking in the city. You know, I knew how to wear a navy blue suit and a white shirt and a tie.
Yeah.
I think I was like the best young preferred vendor in the city.
Mm-hmm.
But something felt so wrong. And I would find myself in those last few years of this design practice I kept under the moniker R. Valicenti Design,
mm-hmm.
pretty creative title. I don't tell this story too often.
So okay.
In fact, I don't think I've ever put it on tape. I'm just snapping out of myself here. but I just know that something's wrong. Two things are happening. I'm getting frustrated. I'm looking at design publications and believing that the best work is happening elsewhere.
Mm.
And at that time, it seemed like it was happening either at Cranbrook or in San Francisco. Quite contrasting portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't happening in my world. The most fun work I was doing, however, was the work I was doing for myself.
Sure.
It would be for a friend, or it would be for a little theater company. In fact, I remember doing designs for the St. Nicholas Theater Company identity. It turned out it was David Mamet's theater company in Chicago.
Yeah.
Or I'd be doing work for the Goodman Theater Company, make a little poster. Well, David Mamet was the director in residence then.
Okay.
Okay, so that wasn't too shabby.
Yeah, so that's a nice turn of luck.
But yeah. I didn't even know who he was,
right.
Because he was just a guy.
But even just having that, in retrospect, your portfolio, to be able to say, I didn't even know it, but
yeah,
I was
we were rubber stamping a poster together because we had $75 to do a poster for the American premiere of Glengarry Glen Ross.
Mm.
Wow. Well, $75. We're working on newsprint, two rubber stamps, and a single line of copy that we were able to print. I have one copy of that. I frankly
yeah.
got it. It's like, well, okay. I got
hang
it.
On to that.
Hang yeah. on to that one. In that time, I took a flight to San Francisco because I called three designers whose work kept showing up and intimidating me in CA Magazine. Michael Cronin, Michael Vanderbilt, and Michael Manwaring. Now, also in San Francisco was Michael Osborne and Michael Mayberry. Andy of Mayberry. No, it was Michael Mayberry. He would like this. Don't edit that. Sure.
Okay.
And I get an audience with those three guys.
Nice.
When I'm there, I'm, again, amazed and intimidated.
Mm-hmm.
Amazed that I got in to see them, intimidated by their presence and their output and the way that they're running their office. And the fact that everything, at least that's what it looked like, they touched, was really good design.
Golden.
Like, how do they do that?
Yeah.
I have to, like, go 2 years to get one thing, and they're doing it every day, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Michael Patrick Cronin, who just passed, sadly,
mm-hmm.
a few months ago, he said to me something that I have held on to dearly. He said, you get what you do. Now, it took years for me to figure out what he really meant by
mm-hmm.
that, but now I've come to define it this way. If you do crap, you're going to get crap. If you do stuff that's, like, highly strategic or formulaic, sure enough, that next job you get is going to be that. If you do work that's passionate or of you or that gives you great joy, the next project you get, whether you initiate it or somebody else brings it to you,
mm-hmm.
is going to be one that's full of passion and joy and, you know, great reward.
He had such a Zen master way
from
of
the
just
early
nailing
days.
Something.
Early days, that's right.
He participates in the Creative Summit. He did participate.
And that's
his family does every year.
That's right. And Karen will be there.
And last year, I actually talked to him about this project. And I was telling him, you know, this is what I think I want to do. And we were at the dinner for the volunteers. And you could tell he focused in, you know, that he went, he listened to what I was saying. And I don't even remember now. I know I have it written down somewhere. I don't remember what he said, but he had this just way of saying something that made me feel like I'm doing the right thing and it's going to be okay.
Duncan, you and I are sharing something very special. I'm getting a kind of rash of goosebumps. Michael Patrick Cronin gave me, with those few words, the insight and courage to be who I am.
Sure, yeah.
And he would... in my opinion, was never the best designer, but somehow he had a way with our process and with being creative in this life that makes it possible for others who've come in contact with him to just do it that much easier. So you're one and I'm one.
Yeah.
And there's a gazillion out there. I mean, you just see all the people who sort of rush to say,
when
what
he passed,
oh my God,
everyone you could think of. So I knew Michael Cronin and he made me possible.
Yeah, he touched me. And here's a guy who, you know, will always know him for naming TiVo and Kindle and a few of the quirky things that are out there. But he was also just a kind of delightful, passionate, inspiring person.
Yeah, absolutely.
So my trajectory passes through him. And shortly after I'm in San Francisco, and shortly after I discover that I'm bitching about going to work every day to a friend of mine who's a photographer named Tom Back, I realize I have to close the office. So I go to the clients, and they're all, for the most part, in the financial community. I said, I would like to be a consultant rather than a vendor. I feel like I'm a vendor. When I come here for my assignments, everything's packaged, the budget's done, the photos are in the envelope, the copy's already typed and edited, and you've already figured out the format and the quantity. And you've even given me the deadline.
You're just producing for them. You're not creating for them.
Here, here.
Yeah.
And I asked, I said, is there any way for me to get to that conference table where those decisions are made? And to a client, they all said, no, you're a preferred vendor. We really love how you provide great service. We wouldn't think of going elsewhere. And I ended up saying to all of them, I can no longer do your business. In other words, I left them.
Yeah.
I went into my own studio and I asked people, one of which had been to Yale, one was an intern at the Walker Arts Center. I said, do you know the difference between a vendor and a consultant? And if you do, which are we? Well, they were employees.
Yeah.
I said, I have to close the office. This is just not right. I closed the office. I took some equipment. I moved to a really rugged part of town. And on the first day I show up after having moved all my stuff in.
Yeah.
I come into this new studio. I'm all excited. Yes, I'm going to start over. I'm an employee of a staff of one, me.
Yeah.
And there are body size holes cut in the drywall in the shape of a body, you know, 16 inches between those studs, and all of my IBM computer equipment's gone.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. I'm going, fuck. This is like a nasty day, first day of work.
Yeah.
Have I made a big mistake here?
Yeah, that's a message.
That was a message. And I thought, well, I can either turn around and go back or I can forge forward.
Yeah.
So I stayed the course, patched the walls. We bought new equipment, but this time we bought this thing called the Apple because this is 1988.
Okay.
In 1985, it had been introduced, or 84. And we didn't know what to do with it. I certainly didn't know what to do with it as a design tool.
But you knew you needed one.
I knew I needed something for the accounting part of the business. And now I'm looking at the work of April Grimen, and I see what she's doing with this thing called Macintosh.
Yeah.
And I have no clients, I have no work, and I get a call on this day. And this is clearly, I think, from Michael. You know, you get what you do. I want to do good work.
Yeah.
I'm going to set that course. And I get a call from the Museum of Contemporary Art. They want me to do a poster. I'm sorry, we can't pay for this poster. But we'd really love for you to do a poster for the t-shirt contest. Great. And a few days later, I get another call from the Lyric Opera of Chicago. They say, we'd like you to compete for the new identity. And we've invited two other designers, Art Paul. You probably know Art Paul. He's the design director of Playboy and co-founder.
Mm-hmm.
And John Mansi. Mm-hmm. He was the design director of Container Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, I know those guys. Those are like the senior guys. And John was on the STA board. And I said, they're competing too, and you want me to compete? Well, the woman who made this call said, well, we can't pay for the competition. I said, that's okay. I'll do this. I have no other work.
So this is where one of my questions kind of comes in. That how did they call you? Did they know of you because of your previous studio?
I'll tell you. I think it goes like this. Woman shows up from, I think, Montreal,
uh-huh.
or wherever the Canadian World Expo was. She's a Canadian,
yeah.
and she has managed the marketing of that. She moves to Chicago to work for Lyric Opera, and she's tasked with giving it a new face.
Okay.
And so it starts with the identity. I think what she did was she looked to the communities that spread the word of designers.
Okay.
In those days, it was the printing community, and it was the other designers.
Yeah.
And
it's been a word of mouth.
A word of mouth, okay. Totally word of mouth. Because, you know, if you go to lunch with a printer, it doesn't take long before it turns to gossip. You're done with the weather
sure.
conversation. You're done with politics. You're done with local sports. And then all of a sudden you're into, like, well, who's doing cool work? Or,
yeah.
you know, have you seen the work of this person?
Right.
Needless to say, I have been doing some personal freelance work
okay.
that I would share with others. Or I would do a poster or two for the STA. Because
sure.
I had
okay.
that. And it was always the kind of stuff that would shake up the crowd a bit.
So you had work that was out there that wasn't the work you were doing that you felt like was vendor work.
That's right. It
okay.
was not vendor work. It was actually the personal work. And it got the attention of others in the community. And when this new person from the outside wanted to find somebody,
mm-hmm.
she puts me on a list. And notice who she had done. She had looked at the head of Container Corporation
right.
in America, the best kind of art designer in Art Paul,
mm-hmm.
and the young guy who has no reputation.
Mm-hmm.
I win the competition, and for the award, I get to do a poster for a play or an opera called Tannhauser,
okay.
being directed by a young guy out of Los Angeles named Peter Sellers.
We may have heard that name before.
Yeah, yeah. And so I get to meet Peter. I photograph the poster, hand cut the type, do all the stuff, get it printed. That poster and the one for the MCA both are reproduced in ID Magazine.
Nice.
As they happen to look to Chicago.
Okay.
And they see these two things. And I get the most press from any other designer in Chicago in this particular article.
Nice. So they picked them. You didn't submit them.
That's right.
Okay.
It was an editor. Her name was Chi Perlman.
Mm-hmm.
And she was not then the head editor. She was just a contributing writer. And she sees this. And all of a sudden, I am on the map.
Nice.
Very nice. I
yeah.
get a couple of big opportunities, and the office starts to grow.
Mm-hmm.
I, to this day, say to the people in the studio, if you don't bring your own personal curiosities and that spirit into the office, we'll never move from where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
It is that which is the magnet.
Sure.
It's the stuff that is really us that we need to celebrate.
Mm-hmm.
Without it, we're just designers.
Yeah.
Spec and type. Pull in the pull-down drawer. What font do I pick today? Right?
Right.
It's all kind of, as I say, off the shelf until something runs through us as individuals.
Sure.
And like filters, it reflects our sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't help but be unique.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and when it's unique, you know how that feels. And you go, oh my God, I put myself out there.
Yeah.
That's both scary and rewarding.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's one of the scariest parts about being a designer. I think that's what drives so many designers to...
Drink.
No, I'm sorry. or other vices. But I guess I was thinking some of the jobs that we all say we hate. You know?
Oh, yes, I know. And as we get older, I mean, just look at the trajectory. I would not want to be a young designer today without the insights of this conversation, for instance, where I got Michael Cronin's pat on the back. I hope some designer listening to your podcast is going to get my pat on the back.
Sure.
Because right behind us is a whole generation of younger people.
Right.
Who can do the normal stuff just as fast, if not faster, than we can.
Yeah.
we're easily replaced. And as we get older and as we get married or want to have a family, our salary demands get higher.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we bring something magical to that level of performance,
yeah,
there's someone else right behind us who can do everything we're doing now,
yeah,
cheaper, maybe faster, or expendable.
Right. Yeah, the mechanical side is automatable.
That's right.
That's the right word. Yeah, it's interesting. It's something we talk about in school, you know, that if you just want to be a logo designer and you don't want to bring anything to it, they're doing those for $99 and getting them out of India right now.
That's right.
You know, and probably cheaper out of China, you know, and what is it you're going to bring to that that the client can't get for $50 and, or $100 online, you know? And yeah, that's a side part of why I wanted to start the podcast is I think people need to hear that part of the discussion, you know, that when you're going to design school, yeah, sure, you need to learn how to use the software, but that's the foundation of the technical side of what you're going to do. And there's so much more that comes after that.
Yes. That sort of, comes not only after, but before it. You know, before you can
True.
Sit down to make
yeah.
it, you have to have some inspired thinking.
Right.
2 years ago, I had the privilege of sitting in an AIGA conference on education in Los Angeles at Art Center, and Meredith Davis was at the podium. She heads the program at NC State. I think the statistic I'm about to share is way old now.
Okay.
She said, every year, 50,000 students graduate at the undergraduate level from or with a design degree.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, 50,000. There's 50 states in America. Are there 1,000 designers practicing in Anchorage every year? Or in Wyoming or Idaho?
Yeah.
Or
right.
The answer is no, they're
no.
not.
Yeah.
So where are they going? Well, they're going to the same major markets that we're in, whether it's Austin or Chicago or Minneapolis,
yeah.
New York. Wow, we're absorbing like 2,000 people in Chicago? Maybe. Can't imagine there being 2,000 studios or 2,000 openings.
Mm-mm.
But it's a reminder that the competition is really there. And
sure.
the skill set is higher. People are exposed to design at a much earlier age.
Right.
And we have to just be, just have to remain confident and courageous and absorb our role as leaders without being arrogant.
I feel like we have to embrace it. We don't have any other choice.
Yes,
you know?
That's right.
And so we have to just find our, we have to find our place in that world. You know, it's not going to change, and it's going to, there'll be more next year. You know, if there were 50,000 this year, there'll be 60,000 next year. And so, yeah, we have to just see where it goes. And I think I see a lot more designers, even myself being in my 30s, I feel like an older designer now, which I know sounds ludicrous.
Ask for a cane for Christmas. Yeah.
But you know, because I see the kids coming out of undergrad that are talented and they're fast, and I just go, wow, you know, I'm back in graduate school and they're coming right out of undergrad and they're looking to get jobs that I would have killed to have had the opportunity to get. And what am I going to do? You know, because they're not when you're in your 30s, they're not looking at you for those jobs as much anymore. You know, so you have to start trying to figure out how to get the jobs there are fewer of, or make your own work and things like that.
Yes, make your own work or help lead and shepherd young talent
right.
to good places.
Which I'm starting to see, from my point of view, that maybe it's just something I'm starting to see, maybe it's something that's newer, I'm not sure, but I'm starting to see that role, part of the role of making your own work is making yourself available to be a teacher or a mentor or a colleague in conversation anyway, you know, I think that that's an important thing that designers have not always done as well, you know, and maybe it's just that I hadn't seen it before and they have done it before, but, and maybe it's being in Austin, where I know Austin is a design center, but it still feels far removed from the other design centers. But it seems like that with technology and with the world getting as much smaller as it is, that we're all having this a greater responsibility to talk with each other.
Agreed. I think you just mentioned a couple of key words. You mentioned mentoring.
Mm-hmm.
Mentoring's been going on for a long time. You know, it used to be under the name of like apprenticing.
Right.
Long before Donald Trump. However, the role of a designer who's older, if they make that conscious to be a mentor, it's quite a good gift.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I answer the question that most young designers ask me, like, what should I look for in my first job? My answer is always the same, a mentor.
Mm.
Without it, you're just, you know, a member of Kathy Lee's sweatshop or something.
True, yeah.
It's not good. So the mentoring, make that conscious. And the other thing that you were alluding to, which I think is of real value, is know that to design a studio environment or to design opportunities for other designers, you know,
mm-hmm.
create the environment for amazing things to happen,
mm.
that's a gift in and of itself. Not everyone can do that.
Right.
And the person who does that need not necessarily be the person who is the form poet.
Mm.
They might not even need to be the strategic genius.
They're a facilitator.
Well, they're more than that. They're the designer of the opportunity and the environment in which it takes place.
Okay.
We can look to Hollywood and say, well, where does that happen best? I think that happens best at the producer level.
Sure.
Where they've sort of created the team, right? They brought
mm-hmm.
in the cinematographer and the director and the actors.
Yeah.
And they orchestrate that thing. They review the script. And if it doesn't work out good, who's to blame?
Sure.
The producer. But who receives the Academy Award when that gets Best Picture?
The actors and the director. And
the producer speaks.
True.
The producer
yeah.
speaks at that
True.
Moment.
Yeah. When the big award, the producer is the one that gets the talk.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I think that is a really good model that I'm conscious of. In the Thirst Studio, I to this day do about a third of the creative output.
Yeah,
I initiate maybe 75 to 80% of all the new business.
Okay.
And I'm there just about every day, unless I'm here in Austin, seeing that the connections between the talented ones are alive and kicking, seeing that the gates are open for good client participation,
yeah.
and they're kind of closed when that participation might be disruptive to the good vibe.
Sure.
All of that is by design.
Yeah.
Without it, it could be disruptive, and it could develop a kind of spirit of contempt.
Sure.
Like those moments when someone says, "The client made me do it."
Mm-hmm.
You know, that should never happen.
So you really take an active role in curating that time that they would have.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. In fact, it's very conscious as to how it was orchestrated.
Do you find that's unique to your studio?
No, I don't know, because I don't work in any other studio. You know, I've worked on this.
From talking to other designers
yeah,
and things?
I think
so?
Some of the other designers are... that I've talked to are less conscious of it. I'm
yeah.
sure they do it. The best ones must.
Yeah.
Because it's too hard for any real good amount of work to happen by one person.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to have the esprit de corps. You need to have a kind of generation underneath. You need
Absolutely.
People who have been there a long time. So in order to make that happen, how does the table get set for the creative act?
Yeah.
Someone at the top has to do that.
So
they define the culture.
That really gets around to a big point of what, especially in my writing about my thesis, a big point for this whole podcast, and that how you create that atmosphere. I know the work that you produce all seems, or at least from what I've seen, you know, you seem to have found a way to make that work very well. And find clients to work with that you can be yourself with, or that you can express a more of a creative, I'd say, outcome than a lot of work, you know, and I think a lot of designers struggle with how to make that work possible. So do you feel that comes from how you're choosing clients, or does it come from the work you've done in the past and therefore clients that come to you?
You get what you do.
Yeah.
Right? So the work, I believe, is the magnet for new opportunities.
Yeah.
And it's the sustaining factor to keep the same clients there year after year.
Sure.
We're still working for that woman at the Lyric Opera.
Yeah.
The same woman. She's about to retire some 30 years later.
Yeah.
But we are still engaged with her. It's a fantastic long-term relationship. I have about three of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't made as much money as my clients, so I guess I'll be working much longer than they will. The real point is that the work generates it. But I think your other point you were underscoring has to do with what happens inside the studio to make that happen. And I want to speak about standards and what it feels like to be onto something good.
Okay.
This is where it gets a bit touchy-feely. But you've heard people say, you know, when it works, it works.
Right.
Or it felt right.
Yeah.
And it's easy to discount that. In fact, it's so difficult to talk about it that it's easy to discount it. Like, how do I critique that if it felt right?
That's an interesting insight, though, because it is discounted so often.
Right.
And even the people that are best at it, they discount it, but it can come off like they make it sound like it's easy.
No, it's actually very hard.
It is very hard. And they know that. And they'll admit that. But often when you hear them talk about that point of inspiration, any designer, I think we all tend to discount it. I've never heard anybody point out that we discount it because it's hard to talk about.
It's very hard to talk about. So imagine this. We're at a conversation. We're at the conference table. You and I are working on a design project. Maybe there's a couple other people there. And we need to know kind of where to start and where to end.
Mm-hmm.
I usually tell everybody, clients included, let's start at the end. Let's just imagine us being done. We're sort of reviewing the brief.
Envision the outcome?
Not formally, but just how it feels.
Sure, yeah.
You know, the success we're getting because we've done such a fabulous job. And some of the things that might have happened as a result of us doing this work.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon, as you paint that scenario of you being at the end, you start to illuminate that path between where you are and where you're going to be.
Right.
It's not to say that there aren't some surprises and some detours and tributaries along the way that make you go, you know, somewhere new, but it does sort of say, okay, now we know that. It also does something that is most important. We get to understand what the standard of excellence is as a group.
Right.
When you do that, now you're dancing with another partner. You're kind of feeling how to move. One person's going backwards, one person's going forward, one person's leading, but both are responding in real time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the perfect dance.
Mm-hmm.
It happens on stage with jazz musicians. It happens in the design studio with designers. So when you're responding, you kind of know when something's right and when something's not so good.
Sure.
And you give each other just enough leash, in dog reference, to go somewhere where you might not expect there to be the answer.
Uh-huh.
With the hope that something is there.
Right.
If nothing's there, then you know a closed door has revealed the path as much as an open door.
Sure.
So you take a left or right or a back turn, but you're always dancing, you're always responding, and you're always working towards that same standard of excellence. What does that feel like?
Yeah.
If you know what it is and you know how it feels, you'll know when it feels right.
Sure.
And that's the magic moment. You know, sometimes we find ourselves going, man, we got it now. Now we can turn into producers, or now we can have a great thrill in sort of making it and presenting it.
Yeah.
It's even much more fun when a client is right there.
Sure.
Now, all of what I described doesn't take us to the shelf where we're pulling formula number 78 off the shelf.
Yeah.
Sometimes this is a lot of making. You know, they call it thinking, making, or design thinking, whatever the nonsensical title is for this methodology, it's really iterative thinking. It's considered decision making. Mm-hmm. It's like, is it this, is it that? And before long, you get to a place that you didn't imagine being,
mm-hmm.
or you got to a place that felt just like you hoped it would feel.
Yeah.
And you started at the end, and you're proud.
Yeah.
Now, that standard, that process is embodied in the artifact.
Mm-hmm.
If I do something that's strategic, I assure you my artifact is going to reflect that strategic thinking.
Mm-hmm.
If I do something that's whimsical, my artifact is going to be the carrier of that whimsy.
Yeah.
So if I do something that's crap, if my process is stilted,
mm-hmm.
if my exchange collaboratively is jaded.
Or forced. Yeah.
You just know that artifact is nothing but a window into its past.
Sure.
It carries all of it.
That's so good.
Isn't that good?
That's really good.
So you can tell sometimes just by like touching a brochure or looking at a logo.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you just go, that's not right.
I think they wanted the wrong thing out of it in the first place.
One of the judges at yesterday's under consideration
mm-hmm.
competition, this brand new thing that Armin put on. One of the judges was a woman named Laura Romanoff. She's my client who I brought. She said, I just can't believe this. There's so much work here that shouldn't even be here. If the people who entered it thought this was their best work, God forbid what their other work is like.
Wow.
Isn't that something?
That is.
And I thought, oh my, I've judged a lot of shows and never heard it put quite like that.
Yeah.
She goes, they spent money to enter something that was reflective of a process that was not enlightened, that was not at the level
yeah.
that one would want it to be. And other projects, just by contrast, would be so pure that you couldn't even change a color without destroying the object.
Right, yeah.
You go, oh my God, that's like pitch perfect.
Yeah.
Because the designer found that groove.
Mm-hmm.
They brought their client with them, their collaborators with them. They knew exactly what that sensibility was. And if it was out of tune on the tuning fork,
mm-hmm.
they would hit it again and get it back on tune.
How great is it to even just... I didn't hear Laura say that yesterday, but just to hear a client gets that.
Client gets that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems so hard to find clients that get it, and maybe that has something to do with how we approach them, I guess, it seems like you've really, yeah.
But, I don't have a deep relationship with Laura. I've only worked with her for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I invited her, I did it selfishly. I could have invited long-term clients who would have enjoyed this time.
Uh-huh.
Immediately, they would have enjoyed the invitation.
Sure.
Instead, I used this opportunity to invite Laura to expose her to not only Karen Fong and Joe Duffy, but the process and all the other examples of design so that
yeah.
she could see design more holistically
uh-huh.
or from a position that she would never get to see graphic design,
sure.
right? She would get to see the good and the excellent and the not so good. Well, when I invited her, it's like, sure, I'll come to Austin. Then a couple weeks goes by and she goes, Rick, I'm really nervous about going.
She started nervous yesterday.
She was very nervous. Yeah,
yeah.
She's been nervous for a long time.
Yeah.
She says, I don't know anything about this world. I said, Laura, you have good taste.
Mm-hmm.
Just come and share.
Yeah, that's what you told her yesterday
yeah.
morning. Yeah.
Just be you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the best you can ask anybody to do.
Sure.
Trust your sensibilities. I say that to any young designer.
Mm-hmm.
Trust your sensibilities. They are the only thing you've got.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, a client is going to gravitate to your sensibilities. They're going to come through either in your artifact or in meeting you or your poise or the way in which you surround yourself in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
They go, boy, I really want to hang out with Duncan. He's got a great sense of humor. He didn't just like fabricate that sense of humor. It's who he is.
Sure.
Or he's
yeah.
got a great sense of form or he's
whatever.
Got a great
yeah.
sense of typography. Like, yes, that's him.
Sure.
And they go there because they want that.
Yeah, it's the... You can study everything and you can learn how to fake it very well, but there's something that you can't fake authenticity.
That's right. You
yeah.
can't hide from yourself.
Yeah. I yeah. That may be a good time to, a good way to wrap it up.
Okay, let's end on You Can't Hide From Yourself. Good.
That's good. Thank you so much, Rick.
Oh, you're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Make Ready Podcast episode number 4. After talking with Rick Valicenti, I feel like I have a new dear friend. His encouragement about this project and design in general are something I still think about on a daily basis. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed talking with Rick. Please join me for the next episode. And remember, you get what you make. This is Duncan Robertson with Make Ready Podcast.